Grade 1 Conference, Lecture 47, Storytelling, Part 10. In this final lecture on storytelling, believe it or not, it is the final one, I am going to talk to you a little bit about method of presentation to the first graders. And of course, in the end, it's going to be your own personal style. You're going to tell stories as best you as you can in a way that's unique to you. And you've probably had your share of good examples in people with whom you've interned or people in your training or colleagues. So this is probably one of your strong suits as a teacher, and that's great. And my suggestions, again, are only that, suggestions. Nothing here is absolute or dogmatic. But I do want to say that absolutely you have to remember that you are teaching into the child's etheric being, and that means that you have to at least have some quality of teaching out of the etheric world, which is different from the astral world. And that means, of course, that you're going to downplay the drama. You do not have to change your voice to reflect different characters, and you certainly do not have to contort your body to show you're a witch or stand very majestically to show you're a queen. But rather, there can be an even quality. And I don't mean even in the sense of it being dead and monotone, but rather, this summer, go and spend, let's say, half an hour or more contemplating a lake or even a pond. And there you might see something on a very quiet day, absolutely still, reflecting everything around it. And then a few minutes later, a slight breeze blows, and suddenly there's a quality of rippling, and the reflection gets broken up a bit. You would still say, oh, this is very serene. What a calming thing to look at. Yet, if you really are watching, you see all kinds of slight changes, nuanced differences that are appearing on that surface. Let that be your model. Let that be your guide. And better than the guide I'm going to give you in the instructional video on storytelling, which you're invited to watch next. But don't feel that you have to do what many a professional storyteller does today, which is to, you know, put on a big show. It's not about entertaining the children, which is not to say that it is about not entertaining them. There can be an element of entertainment in it, and there can be suspense in it, and there can certainly be drama. But just to recognize that the words alone in first grade and mostly in second grade alone as well are sufficient for conveying to the children all that needs to be conveyed. Let them have their lively, imaginative response to it inwardly. And for some, it won't be inward. They'll be reacting and responding and, oh, no, don't let her do that. That sort of thing will happen. And that's wonderful, without you having to push any buttons or anything like that. And I've also appended to the conference a segment of a longer video, which is taken from a conference that I helped to lead with the Princeton Waldorf School pretty early in the 21st century. And this was a conference in which a group of us were explaining what Waldorf education is to a fairly large group of public school teachers in New Jersey. So this was when the charter school movement was just getting underway on the West Coast and was non-existent on the East Coast. And there was little in the way of interaction between the public school world and the Waldorf school world. So as part of my talk, I gave a demonstration of sort of several things at once, but it really has a lot to do with how we try to tell a story. And although I use props, you'll find that the storytelling itself remains pretty even-keeled. And my voice doesn't change, my gesture doesn't change a whole lot. And what I like especially about this video, not me when you see me, but rather that there were two cameras so that the audience was being filmed as well. And you know, that's the most important thing. When I visit a classroom, it's wonderful to see a teacher, you know, doing a great job up there. But what's much more important is how are the children reacting, not whether they're being taught. Of course, the teacher is teaching, but what are they learning? What are they taking in? And you need to kind of turn the camera back there. So you will see how even adults, who perhaps have been a little bit toughened by their work as teachers in New Jersey public schools, how they are reacting to what is going on in this storytelling. And what I show, one thing I show is that, you know, when we give children toys today in the mainstream world, the toys are completely finished. There's nothing left for the child. They don't even have to make them walk around or move because they're battery powered. So the child just becomes a passive onlooker as the toy does all the work. What we try to do, in a way, is in kindergarten, of course, to give children the simplest materials, like a piece of silk that you'll see in the film, and let them bring it to life. Let them use their surplus of etheric forces, their abundance of life, and use their imagination to make many things out of something that's very simple. And that's our approach in storytelling as well. You know, let the children fill in the gaps of drama and of movement and of emotion. We should not do that for them. But that doesn't mean that we are passive, by no means. We are inwardly very active when we're telling the story. First of all, we are looking at those four groups of children who are seated, ideally, according to the temperaments, and we are generally directing the story to about 25 or 50% of the class at any one time. Rarely, if ever, to the whole class. I spoke about this in discussing the temperaments. So where you have a very sad scene in which the princess has been imprisoned in a dungeon and may have to remain there forever and ever, the melancholics are the ones to whom you want to be addressing your words. And they will be taking that in very deeply and sort of confirming how sad life basically is. When there's a great feast, perhaps a marriage feast that goes on for 7 days and seven nights, and all of the peasants get to sit with the nobility and eat to their heart's content, you may want to have a glance towards the phlegmatics. And not even that you have to be looking at them, staring at them. Get it, guys? Get it? But rather that your consciousness is directed towards them. And they will be very engaged in that. And number three, if you're talking about things with great variety, the many jewels that were in the king's treasure trove, the combing of the long golden hair of the princess, or the beautiful silks and woolens and multicolored fabrics that were lining the queen's throne, then the sanguines really awaken. And anything that's at all tending towards romance or someone liking someone falling in love with another, there again, the sanguines will carry the show for that. And the cholerics like to hear about challenges, about warfare, valiance, and also sometimes about people who seem to be doing very silly, foolish things who turn out in the end to be very wise indeed. Cholerics like that kind of twist as well. So as you're focusing on one group, you are really carrying the other groups as well. They're also getting engaged with the story in that way. And this is going to be important not only on the first day you tell the story, but when you retell it and sort of emphasize this again, and when you review the story and have the children talk about what they remember. And this is, in many ways, I said that storytelling was the heart of first grade. The retelling by the child, by the children in the class, is the heart of the heart. It's the most central thing in grade one, because here we are asking them to develop their memories so that they can not only take something in, but can begin to give it back. And by and large, when I visit first grades, the review segment is one of, I have to say, the most disappointing things that I see. I see wonderful things going on many, many levels, but the review does not seem to be so well understood. So here are some of the things that I observe that the teacher will say. The prince realized that there was only one way that he could meet that dragon. He would have to go where? Where a child raises her hand. Yes, where? In the dark wood. In the dark wood. Very, very good. So the prince moved very stealthily through that dark wood. And then in the distance, he saw something. What did he see? A few hands raised. Yes, he saw a light. Very good. He saw a light. Well, yeah, that's kind of a review. But number one, you're not asking the children to form sentences. You know, be economical. Whenever the child speaks, there you have a potential grammar lesson. Have the child, first of all, if you just want them to answer something that simple, if that's all you want of them, even that can be done in a complete sentence. You know, he walked in the woods and he saw a light is a better answer than a light. He knew he had to go into the deep woods is a better answer than the deep woods. But if you're forming the question in such a way that you're only allowing the child to give a one or two word answer, that's what you're going to get. That isn't really coming out of the child. It's not something they've digested and made their own. It's just kind of spitting something back at you. Excuse the crude analogy, but that really is kind of what it is. You're not giving them a chance to digest it and savor it, but it's just kind of, okay, you know, what happened then? What happened then? So don't work that way. It's much better for you to call a child up and ask them to tell part of the story. You know, in the early weeks of school, you get the ball rolling by beginning the story so that they, you know, their recollections are brought up to speed. And then after that, a child talks for perhaps a minute or maybe 2 minutes. 2 minutes is a long, long time when you're speaking. And then the child sits down, and I would suggest the child either stands at her desk or comes up to the front of the room so that the children learn to look and listen to one another, not just the teacher, and that they develop respect for whoever is standing up before them, be it a teacher or someone, one of their own class. And at least that the child stands up at the desk, so that there's something different. There's an uprightness, there's a little bit of egoity that's coming there. And, well, maybe another child says, but she forgot, just a moment, wait, let her finish. The child finishes, sits down, and then perhaps the child who realizes the first girl forgot something can correct it politely, waiting her turn to do so. Now, do you only call the children who raise their hands? If you do that, and some teachers do because it's just so much easier, you're going to end up with five children always dominating the review. Probably two of those will do two-thirds of all the reviews, and the other three will do the remaining third. You know, and that just kind of sets up a hierarchy in the class. Oh, yeah, Sarah's always good. She's always knows the whole story. And, well, what about you? Don't you know anything? Asks the mother. I do, but, you know, Sarah's so good, and Mrs. Jameson always chooses her because she always knows it. No, no, we don't want that. And there's only one way to help bring about some equity in this whole situation of who's A, confident, who B, likes to talk, who 3, has a great memory. You know, of course, not everybody is equally endowed with all of this. But you make sure, and we go back to the way we are observing the children every day, you know, 2 or 3 at a time intensely, that in the course of every month, at least every month, you've heard from every child once. And it'll probably end up that you've heard from a number of children twice because you call them up. And a child will say, I don't know. And you give them a little hint. Remember, the prince knew he had to fight that dragon, but the dragon, what dragons don't like the sun much? Where would he have to go? Then the prince had to go in the dark wood because the dragon always wanted to be in the darkness, and the prince knew that he would have a hard time. So suddenly, you know, you've said a few words, and it starts to flow out of that child. There will also be other children who won't want to sit down. They'll go on and on and on. And that's okay to let a child speak for 3 minutes if they must, but not make a habit of it because you want to be sure that you're fair, that every child gets a fair hearing. But what about the child who simply does not know, who just says, I don't know. But what did the dragon say to the prince about that gold? I don't know. That's fine. Let that child stand up there, feed him a few lines, you know, kind of say something and have him repeat that or whatever. As long as he stands up there and talks, that is what's most critical and most important. You want every child in your classroom to feel confident, to feel relaxed, to feel able to stand before their classmates and to be able to elicit something or other from their memory. It will take some children 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years before they are simply able to come to the front of the class and be able to speak out of themselves. But they're never going to do it, never, 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 even in adulthood, unless you get them started. And I'd say, no time is too soon to do that. So everyone knows they're in the spotlight at some point or other. They're going to get called, and it's not just the best and brightest who run the show. We'll see that's also going to be true with arithmetic as well. It's very important that it's not just the people who wave their hands most passionately who get called, though you don't want to ignore them. You know, you also should call every day one or two who are really eager to speak. But you could also say, we've heard a lot from you this week, Joanne, so let's call on someone else and be fair. And that's fine for those children. They're all right with that as well. What you do not want, the cardinal rule of the Waldorf classroom, is for people to shout out the answers. So here's another absolute, here's dogma for you. Don't let children call out answers. And you know who's the biggest sinner in this regard, why this happens throughout the grades, in class after class I visit all over, and probably happened just as much in my class, who's to blame? You are, the teacher. Because you're so happy to hear the right answer that you forget it's totally in violation of code 1AQ3, no shouting out in the classroom. I do not acknowledge anyone who has not raised his or her hand. That rule is broken again and again and again by teachers. And you have to be such a guardian of your own wakefulness about that. It also happens when your back is turned to the class, when you're doing form drawing or writing numbers on the board, and a child shouts out the answer and you don't notice if they had their hand up. And even if they did have their hand up, that still doesn't qualify them to shout out an answer, because you have to acknowledge them. You have to choose them. And then they may give the answer. So work on that one, because that turns the review into a bit of a shambles as well. So you want the review to be, for you, a diagnostic test of the children's memory forces and how they work with those. And here's how you can help. Not guarantee that everyone will be able to say something, but sort of give the better odds that children will do that. You call on children according to their temperament. So you know in the next scene, the prince is about to go to a castle and eat the most wonderful meal of his life. Very possibly, the phlegmatics will remember that story, one or another of them. Phlegmatics are usually the ones whose memories are the slowest to retrieve. So even with that, they won't necessarily do it. But give it a try. Where there's food, where there's comfort, sleeping, whatever, ask a phlegmatic to come up. The melancholics will love to relate in mournful tones all of the sad parts of the story, and they'll remember those vividly, though melancholics have memories like elephants, and they generally could stand up there and tell the entire story with all of your little nuances just as well as you could, but they'll definitely be able to speak of the sad parts. The sanguine children, where there's variety, where there's beauty, where there's love, where lots of things are happening at once, that's where the sanguine children will probably be able to remember and recall. And the cholerics, the challenges, the exciting parts. And, you know, I'm not meaning to be superficial and stereotypical here, but just try it and you'll see for yourself that if you think of these things temperamentally, that you the day before planted seeds in the various temperamental groups, and now they're ready the next day to bring that up. And pay very careful attention to how children do in the recollection section, because that says a lot. That's telling you a lot. Are their etheric forces now becoming increasingly accessible to memory? Or are they still growing too much? Or are parts of their body not yet fully organized and developed, and the etheric forces aren't there yet for memory? You know, the children's memories develop, especially in the first three grades, at very different rates. And it doesn't mean this child has a learning disability or that child, you know, isn't smart or something like that. It all has to do with the activity of the etheric body. As we see again and again, we keep coming back to the centrality of the etheric body for everything we do. So those are my suggestions to you over these past 10 lectures about storytelling, its importance, the role that it plays in the class and in the child's own soul development. Next, we have a little video demonstration of aspects of telling a story. If you want to read the story, it's The Devil and the Three Golden Hairs. I will not be telling the whole story. It's a long one, But I'll give excerpts and then a little commentary. We'll go on to that.